Song is called 3 Days Blind. Music from Larnell Harris, all about that road to Damascus. Good morning to you. It is now 13 and a half minutes past the hour, 13 and a half past 8 here in our central time zone. David Adam Punt is with us. I'm Jim Park, and joining us from Garden Valley, Texas, Dr. Don Clark. Don, good morning.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Don.
And you got 54 degrees and probably sunshine, don't you?
Well, it's actually overcast today, it's forecasted to be sun.
Well, misery loves company, so I'm glad it's overcast, at least.
it'll burn off.
it's bright and sunny where I am.
Well, yeah.
Yeah,
it's cloudy like where you are, huh?
You're looking a little overexposed, David, there. I mean, the sun is in your face there. I didn't
just barely see who I am.
Have to get some blinds for the newsroom there, I think. So, we were talking last week about radio dating, and we're not talking about websites that match you up with singles. We're talking about dating of archaeological finds and artifacts, and this whole question of how scientific is science, or this what. When we hear, well, for example, last week Dave and I were talking about, because we go through interesting curiosities from this date in history, and one of the things we came up with was a 150-million-year-old fossil egg was found. This was after our discussion last week, Don, and my first thought was, how do they know it's 150 million years old? Because you pretty well knocked the legs out from under radio dating. And tell us, just recap for us that study that indicated that some of the scientific assumptions connected with radio dating are not necessarily valid.
Okay, yes, it's most dating. We'll talk about fossil dating in a minute, but let's talk about dating of the rocks, because that's really what we're talking about here, is done by radioisotopes. So you look at a parent isotope and see how much is there, and then you look at a daughter isotope. That is, let's take uranium. Uranium degrades to polonium and ultimately to lead. So if you look at the ratios of the parent, which is in this case is uranium, degrading to lead, and you look at how much lead is in the rock and how much polonium is in the rock, uranium is in the rock, then you can guesstimate, how old the rock is based on a couple of assumptions. One is that the radioisotope decay is constant throughout history, which we talked about last time as being a poor assumption based on the polonium halos that were observed. And the other assumption is that you're starting off with pure uranium, that there was no lead in the mineral to begin with. Mm-hmm. So those two assumptions are fairly big assumptions when you're talking about millions of years. So when we're talking about dating fossils, most fossils are not dated directly. The way they are dated is you look at what strata you found the fossil in, what layer of earth you found the fossil in, and you say, oh, well, this is from this period of time. And you've already dated that period of time, hopefully from the rocks, and you say, okay, then that layer is between 100 to 200 million years old, so therefore we're assuming that this egg is 150 million years old.
That's quite. Now, that's a plus or minus 50 million years. Is that what? Is that the degree of accuracy we're dealing with here?
Oh, it can be depending on. You can have two different rocks from the same layer and get quite divergent, answers from your radio dating. And not only as we talked last time that the dating is probably bogus because there appeared to be two accelerations in the decay rate. In history, at least, probably at creation, and the other time is the Genesis flood.
Mm-hmm.
So, you really can't say what the dates are, but the typical scenario is that we would date the rocks and we found this fossil in this layer, so we assume that this layer is this old, so therefore this fossil must be this old.
Now, we're talking about a fossil, so we're really talking about a rock, aren't we? A mineralized object. which is no longer an egg, but now closer to a rock.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. The minerals in the material in the egg have been replaced by silicon dioxide and other minerals to produce a hard, a hard fossil that we would see today.
Now, a quick scan of some of the articles concerning this 150 million year old fossil egg talk about X-rays revealing a dinosaur embryo, and they've even named it. And I'm thinking, when this information gets published, and a lot of this is in like the New York Times and its newspapers, not necessarily scientific publications, it leaves the impression in the mind of the public that there really is something 150 million years old here, and therefore the age of the Earth is at least that old. And what I'm hearing from you is that's bunk.
Yeah, that's we can't really tell how old the age of the Earth is based on that information, as I talked about last time, because just to recap very briefly, I don't want to go back to what we talked about last time, but polonium halos that are found in zircon crystals and granites, for example, they shouldn't exist. But there we have it. They're there. Polonium degrades very, very rapidly within days, as opposed to some of these other elements that take millions or billions of years to degrade completely. So there would never be enough buildup of polonium from decaying uranium to ever see it. But we do see it. So that indicates that the decay had to be very, very rapid.
Is there any other way of dating things other than radio dating?
Not from a long period of time. The other thing is that you have the geological column, and we haven't really talked about that. And the geological column is an assumption that these various layers were laid down one on top of each other over a period of time. And so from an evolutionary point of view, you have this layer being laid down and then another layer being laid down. And in these various layers, you might have various type of organisms or fossils that you find. And the problem with that, it's not uniform over all of the Earth. There are some similarities, but it's not uniform. It's kind of an amalgam of what one sees around the Earth. And in actual fact, the geological column is more of evidence of a great flood, a worldwide flood, than it is of any type of evolutionary process that has gone on, or long age, for example.
It seems that great store is put into cores, drilled out of the Earth or even under the ocean at great depths, or in the ice in Antarctica or Greenland. If that layering is not consistent around the world, then how much can truly be learned from drilling for cores, and extracting a tube, a column of that Earth, and then examining the layers?
It goes back to your assumptions. Mm-hmm. And if your assumption is wrong, that each layer represents either a new year, if you're talking about ice layers, or a new season, and then you find out, during a certain period of time, like for example, right after during the Ice Age, when a lot of things were happening, you had multiple layers being laid down in one year, as opposed to each layer of ice representing a year or so of age. So if you look at those layers and you start counting the layers and you say, okay, I've got 10,000 layers here, so I must have 10,000 years. If the layers were laid down, multiple times during the year, you can't say how old your layers are. It's the same way with the geological column, with the Earth strata. If you're assuming that each layer is laid down on top of itself over a long period of time, and that assumption gets knocked out because you look at something like, for example, Mount St. Helens eruption and the canyon that was formed in a very short period of time, and the multiple layers of silt that were laid down within a day or less when all of this mud came sliding down Mount St. Helens. You can't look at what's happened around the Earth and say, gee, that's from long periods of time. And in fact, like I said earlier, it appears that it is from a short period of time and from some form of catastrophe like a great flood.
It's interesting what you say about assumptions, because it may be that science could benefit from the old philosophical axiom that if you encounter a contradiction, it's time to re-examine your premises, because contradictions can't exist.
That's exactly right, and that's what we have with the polonium halos. Is it's a contradiction to what you would think.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's other evidences for a very short or for a rapid radioactive decay process at some time in our Earth's history as well, but that's just one example.
And Mount St. Helens must be a real a fertile classroom for science in general to see what's happened since. What was that, mid-80s? I forgot exactly when they wrote. Yeah.
Yes, it was the, I think it was 83 or something, or you know, mid thereabouts.
And there were predictions that it would be generations before life would be restored, and that's turned out not to be true in the Mount St. Helens area.
That's correct. And I think it's Mirror Lake that was kind of got the brunt of all the trees that came off of off the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing, those trees are beginning to fossilize, and they're standing up in the bottom of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
Much like you would have a petrified forest, for example. So a petrified forest isn't When I look at a petrified forest, I say, gee, this is evidence of a flood, because mm-hmm. these trees are here, they're standing up, they're in different layers of mud that was laid down, you know, you would think over periods of time, but very, very quickly in this case. And you say, this is a catastrophe. You know, this was a result of a catastrophe, a result of a huge flood
mm-hmm.
that happened in this area. So, your assumptions. I mean, you can get widely divergent, you know, answers based on what your assumptions are.
David, did I see a question burgeoning?
No, I was just going to share that Mount St. Helens erupted on May 18th of 1980.
1980. Oh, wow. It's already 30 years ago.
Just trying to help.
Well, thank you. Yeah. David is the gratuitous Googler, and any questions that come up during our discussion will be solved quickly.
I was curious about the, you know, the kind of, I forgot what you called them now, but the growth rings that you were talking about, the polonium, I believe it was.
Halos. Radio halos.
Yeah, radio halos. And it sounds somewhat like counting rings in trees. If you cut a tree down, you can estimate how old the tree was because of so many rings. There seems to be an assumption that that's the way that the Earth grows as well.
Well, not with the radio halos. The radio halos are the result of, in this case, alpha particle decay from the parent, which is polonium, mm-hmm. which came from uranium, and so. It's the ring actually is the distance from the center, which where the polonium would be, determines how much energy that alpha particle has.
Hmm.
And so different elements give off, let's say, alpha particles that have different energies. So they would have different distances from the center of the dark spot, let's say, where the parent material is.
So basically, okay. The presence of plutonium indicates that the basic assumptions were faulty. That in looking for lead and finding some plutonium indicates that the process itself is at fault. Dr. Don, on to something maybe a little more metaphysical. We had a listener comment on one of our broadcasts from a couple of weeks ago when we talked about God's voice. As a creative force, and he wondered if the voice itself somehow had, you know, whether it's vibrations in air, and I'm not sure how much detail we can provide, but I'm wondering what the physics of something like that would be. And again, this is almost a rhetorical question, but not quite. If God spoke something into existence, and maybe if I can back up a step here, because Dave and I have talked about this a couple of times. Your brain, to me, is much like an engine, which takes one form of energy and converts it to another. So we take an idea floating around in our head. Let's say it's a notion for the design. Let's say it's a painting. We have this picture in our head, and we convert it to something physical. That's really a result of our mind combined with our physical ability to move things and touch things and feedback through our eyes. And the process changes once the idea becomes something tangible. Isn't it possible that God as spirit, in formulating a thought, actually performs the creation of that thing in a similar manner, in a much grander scale, of course, than what our brains do with an idea converting it to something physical?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we go back to the premise that we are created in God's image. Hmm. So the physical world that we see is a reflection of the heavenly world that, where God lives in. Now, I'm not saying a one-to-one correlation, of course, but mm-hmm. there are some similar characteristics. So let's go back to, you know, when God spoke and he said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And my question, what did God speak into? Now, when we speak into air. And or we speak into a microphone, we speak mm-hmm. into air. When we speak, we are disturbing the air molecules. We are forming sound waves. In order for us to speak, we have to put energy behind it. We have to fill our lungs with air, and then pass them through our vocal cords, which vibrate, which create the sound. So there is energy involved in that process. And just the same way as if you took a pebble, you threw it in a very still body of water, and when the pebble hits the water, it creates ripples that we can that we can see. And the further out the ripples go, of course, the shallower they are. So we've got this rippling effect. But it was the result of the energy, the kinetic energy that you threw this rock into the water. That created the ripples. So the ripples are just a result of the energy waves. Just as a tsunami, for example, a big 30-foot wave that's coming ashore is a result of some form of energy release. In this case, the Earth's crust has broken or has shifted, which then causes the energy required to form the wave. So when God spoke, one could say, did he speak into nothing? Now, he has the ability to create from nothing, but I believe that Genesis 1 in particular is telling us that he spoke into space-time. First, he created space-time, that is the medium in which we were going to live, mm-hmm. or our heaven, for example, our physical heaven. And when he spoke, he disturbed this space-time, much like when we speak, we disturb the air that's around us. So when he spoke, the space-time was disturbed. And if you know you follow the sequence in Genesis, it starts with light. And we talked, I guess it was two or three times ago, about the process of generating light. Light has the property of both a particle and a wave. It's got a duality nature to it. So it's a wave packet, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so it's got vibrations is what my point is. It's got vibrations in it. So if God spoke, he created light. And from that light, it then says later in that verse that he separated the light from the darkness. And one way of doing that is you put a spin on light. So light normally travels in a straight line, or actually in the line, space lines, really, along space. And if space blood will actually curve. If he actually put a spin on the light, then he could create all of the subatomic particles. And we think now, based on string theory, that there are three vibrating units, if you will, that make up the electron, for an example. And these vibrating units are vibrating around itself, around themselves, and spinning around themselves, and spinning around a very small space. So his voice not only created the energy required, because there's a tremendous amount of energy, as we know, in atomic particles, based on the atomic bomb and nuclear energy, mm-hmm. and all this other stuff, mm-hmm. but there's also a purpose behind this energy. So it's not just random energy, it's directed energy that God did when he spoke. So there was a purpose behind it, and the purpose was to create this physical universe that obviously we live in.
And you talked about the way we speak, and we take in air, and we impart energy to the air and vibrations to it. But superimposed on that is meaning through a series of symbols, sounds, expressions, body language that communicate an idea. And that idea is somehow above all that. That comes from someplace else. And that's where I think we can learn a lot in using that and looking at for a parallel in spirit, where God is preeminent and has the concept to begin with. And he talks about his word not returning to him void, It accomplishes what he sends it out to do. That's a statement of purpose.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if you look at actually verse 2 of Genesis, it talks about his spirit hovering over the face of the waters. Now, I don't, even though that word for waters is the same word for waters used a little bit later in the chapter, I believe the waters in this case was actually space-time. It had this fluid property. But the important part, relating back to what you were saying, was that his spirit was hovering. His spirit was hovering. It's as if his spirit was contemplating. It was thinking and saying, okay, I'm getting ready to create something. This is what I want to create. Here's the image I have in my mind, if you will. I mean, mm-hmm. Who can comprehend the mind of God?
But not me.
Yeah, exactly. But, you can get these pictures. I mean, God communicates to us in a language that, he wants us to understand. Jesus had parables, but those were for people that didn't believe. Mm-hmm. But for us believers, I think, there's nuggets in Scripture that says, here's a little clue. I'm going to just give enough to whet your appetite. And when you get to heaven, maybe we can talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all neat, and for our listener that had the question, which prompted my question, the answer is yes. There is physics to the claim that God spoke all things into creation. In fact, the word "spoke" is key here. He didn't just imagine it. He didn't just think about it and not act. He spoke means he took action, affirmative action and purpose.
That's right. Hmm. Yes. Now in anticipation of us taking action to do things, so thoughts are great, but they don't amount to much unless you actually either write them down, make them available to other people, speak them.
And then it's amazing too how many other people can be involved in the fruition of an idea that maybe you were the catalyst for. But other people have input as well and take it to new heights. And I guess that's applied science, isn't it?
That's right. It's also philosophy. I mean, because you have Karl Marx, for example, that says, well, gee, I think I have this idea and I'm going to write the Communist Manifesto and put down these 10 ideas and we'll all live in a big, happy community. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, we know in a fallen world it doesn't quite work that way. But ideas do have consequences and have power to them.
Ideas have power and a physical component, as it turns out. And you've illustrated that for us beautifully this morning. Dr. Don, thank you so much for joining us. Always appreciate your visits, and we'll look forward to talking to you again next Monday. And as always, I want to give David a chance for one last question here, because sometimes it takes David a while to formulate his questions because they tend to be complex. Go ahead.
Well, I think I spent most of my question on the information about Mount St.
Helens. Plutonium halos.
Yeah.
Okay. Already.
I find everything you talk about very interesting, Don. Very, very fascinating. And I continually I'm struck with the notion, and I guess I've seen this before. I even took a master's course one time on the history of science. And it was the history of scientific explanations. And one of the things that stuck with me from the class was that there tends to be a long period of time in between discoveries, and the time leading up to the discoveries was filled with people who had not just opposite thoughts about the proposed discovery. That was it. That there tended to be a lot of people in opposition to the proposed discovery. I mean, much like Galileo, much like Newton, much like a lot of other scientists. And it seemed like there was the one person who had this particular notion that ended up being correct or being more accepted. Does that make sense? But there was a lot of people who said, no, this notion of gravity, that's ridiculous. It's got to be something else. It's got to be air suction or something. But it seems like that pattern is repeated over and over and over in science.
Yeah, and very much so. I think people are like any of us. It's we don't like change, sometimes new ideas. Yeah, new ideas are take a little while to accept, and sometimes if the idea goes against your fundamental belief, it is very difficult to accept, because that means you have to change your belief system.
And now that clarifies my memory. And it wasn't that all these other people had new ideas or different ideas, but they were stuck in the ideas they'd been living with for their entire lives.
Yeah, and if your new idea happens to kick the legs out from under the power base of the power structure, you're in trouble.
Right.
Galileo being a prime example. Dr. Don, thank you so much, and we'll hope you can join us again next Monday if your schedule permits, because we always look forward to these discussions and appreciate you very, very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim, and thank you, David, for having me. These are always a lot of fun, and I hope to be with you again next week.
Sounds good.
Be blessed, and we'll talk to you next Monday. Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments, creationmoments.com, place you ought to put on your agenda for the day on the internet. Music from Travis Cottrell.